everyone, and welcome back to the Brexit Podcast. This is your host Jennifer Han with my co-host Tim Hemming, and for today's episode we have a recurring guest on, which is Robin Munro from the Institute for Government. Thanks again for coming on, as always.
No problem, I'm happy to do so.
So, yes, on Tuesday, which is yesterday for us, Theresa May finally gave her long-awaited, big, massively important Brexit speech. To your mind, what were the big takeaways?
So I think the first big takeaway for me was that we actually got quite a lot of detail and information about the negotiating objectives in this speech. You know, some people weren't sure whether it would be a kind of restatement of general principles that we've already had, but it certainly added a lot more clarity to the negotiating aims. In terms of other big takeaways, I think Theresa May was very clear that what she wants is certainly towards the end of what people have called a hard Brexit. So she wants to take back control of immigration at the borders. She wants to leave the jurisdiction of the European Courts of Justice. Both of those things involve leaving the single market. And so she would be pursuing a free trade agreement with the EU. So the UK would no longer be a member of the single market, although she'd obviously try and negotiate a high level of access to the single market.
Do you think there are any surprises, Robin?
I wouldn't say there were huge surprises. I mean, Theresa May had always suggested that her priorities would be around immigration, leaving the ECJ and securing a good trade deal. But what I think was notable was that while the kind of Brexit that Theresa May spoke about yesterday was certainly something that hard Brexiteers would be in favour of, so taking back control of borders, taking back control of laws, there were a few points in there that I think were very much designed to kind of give some confidence or some comfort to those that were more in favour of a soft Brexit. So, for example, Theresa May suggested that she might be willing to pay in to the EU budget in return for access to some EU programmes that are seen as beneficial to the UK. So that might be something like research funding. There had been a lot of concern here among universities, for example, that they would lose access to EU funding. So there was some suggestion that that would continue. There were also some very, you know, positive things said about being keen to protect workers' rights and being keen to give clarity on the position of EU nationals living in the UK. So certainly some points that I think were probably designed to assuage some of the concerns of soft Brexiters or people that had voted to remain.
Yeah, in terms of the research funding, that does seem to be quite to the fore, because that was one of her 12 points, wasn't it, that she was maintaining that the investment into the science or scientific research needed to carry on.
Yeah, exactly. And there had already been commitments from the government that they would match funding that had already been committed. But what we found yesterday was a kind of commitment or a promise from the PM that she would be willing to consider not just matching that funding with UK funding, but, you know, paying money into the EU budget to allow UK research to continue to receive EU funding streams.
So she's been characterized in the past a lot as being very evasive and very broad in her answers, very unspecific. How did you find her when answering questions or when talking on Tuesday? Do you think she's cleared up a lot of the issues that people had found? Was there anything that she left out?
I mean, I'll take those in two parts. I mean, there were things that she left out. I'll come to those in a minute. But in terms of, you know, this question of her being evasive, I think to be fair to the Prime Minister, you know, it does take time to decide what your negotiating objectives are. You have to think about the options on the table and what will benefit the UK. And you also have to have discussions in cabinet. And we know that in her cabinet there are, you know, people from both sides of the Brexit spectrum. So she will have had to have had long discussions there before she makes up her mind. So I think although people had felt that she took a while to reveal her negotiating objectives, I think that's just, you know, necessary when you haven't quite decided what you're going to aim for. But I think yesterday we did learn a lot about her top level negotiating objectives, and she was able to give a lot more detail than she had done in the past. In terms of the things that she didn't say, we obviously, while we know her kind of high level negotiating objectives, we don't know the detail of that. So, for example, you know, if there's going to be a free trade agreement with the, between the UK and the EU, we don't know exactly what that will look like. But of course, she cannot commit to that detail before the negotiations begin. Those issues will be questions that have to be hammered out between the UK and the EU institutions. So some of that detail she simply can't give at the moment. Other things that we don't know are, for example, what her red lines would be in the negotiation, and also what her areas of compromise might be. So obviously, when you go into a negotiation, you say the kind of best deal that you want to get, but you don't reveal what you might be willing to back down on and what you wouldn't be willing to back down on. So we don't know that, but we wouldn't have expected the PM to reveal those kind of details. So certainly a few things that we still don't know. Another thing that we don't know is how the negotiations will be managed by Whitehall. So there are several options there. One is that you have a fairly small negotiating team, perhaps based in the Department for Exiting the EU or in UKREP, that will be doing the majority of the negotiations. But you might also want to bring in policy experts from other departments. So, for example, when you're negotiating the details of an agricultural agreement with the EU, you'd want to have policy experts from DEFRA, the Department for the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, because they really understand that the policy details of agriculture. And as far as we know, the mechanisms are not yet in place in Whitehall to allow the negotiators to draw on all of that policy expertise. So there are a few other questions to iron out. Some of those things obviously have to be in place before the negotiations begin. Some things we'll probably never know. You know, we won't necessarily ever find out what the Prime Minister's red lines were, because they would be covered in the negotiations. And then, of course, the detail on future trade arrangements or exactly what future UK-EU cooperation looks like, we won't know until the negotiations themselves start to settle some of those questions.
Do you think this speech should have been made in something like PMQ, so she could have been challenged?
There have certainly been a few people who said that it could have been made in Parliament. But then, of course, David Davis, the Brexit secretary, did then make a statement directly after the speech. So that there was an opportunity then for MPs to discuss with him and to raise their concerns.
So you just touched on the issue of the UK definitely leaving the single market and then May wanting to have sort of a bespoke free trade deal for the UK. Mm-hmm. What are the options of what that would look like? Do we know any of that yet, or is that all quite vague at the moment?
Well, I mean, if you think of the way that free trade agreements have been done in the past, there aren't really a kind of very clearly delineated set of options. I mean, there's obviously a huge range of trade agreements, and they do vary in terms of the detail, how much they cover, how far they go in terms of regularising trade between two nations. But given the embeddedness of the UK in the EU economy, I would imagine that any free trade agreement would have to be quite advanced and go quite far. So you might be looking at something like the EU-Canada free trade agreement. So that went beyond just facilitating trade in goods and also started to facilitate trade in services. And again, we know that the UK has a very large service economy, so it's likely that the UK would want to continue to be able to sell services to the EU. So I would imagine that any free trade agreement would have to go beyond sort of removing tariffs on goods and also start to kind of facilitate trade in services, whether that's, you know, creating equivalent regulations between the UK and the EU in terms of regulating service industries, or whether it's about the ability of the financial services industry in the UK to sell services abroad. Those are the issues that I would expect any free trade agreement to want to cover.
One of the sort of phrases that a lot of people in the press and on Twitter and everywhere else picked up on after the speech is that she said, no trade deal is better than a bad trade deal. Mm. Does that mean that there's actually a chance of the UK exiting the EU without any kind of economic deal with Europe in play?
So, I mean, I think there are two things to say to that. I mean, one is, you know, in response to your question, yes, it is possible that the UK can leave the EU without any kind of deal in place. What it would do then would be fall back on World Trade Organization rules, which govern world trade. It would give it far less preferential access to EU markets than a free trade agreement would, but you know, it would be possible for the UK simply to leave without a trade agreement in place. But I think the other reason why Theresa May would have made that remark yesterday is, again, going back to this negotiating strategy and what you want to show when you're going into the negotiations. And, you know, it makes logical sense that you have a stronger negotiating position if your opponent knows that you are willing to walk away from the table. Whereas if the UK had said, for example, we will not leave without a great trade agreement, then that puts them in a weaker position because the EU can offer a less favourable deal and the UK might feel obliged to accept it because it has to get any kind of deal. So I think while it is possible the UK will leave without any kind of deal, the reason that the Prime Minister would have made that comment yesterday is probably also linked to this idea of strengthening your hand as much as possible before you start talking and making it clear to your opponent, to your negotiating partner, that they can't just give you anything. You are willing to leave with nothing.
Mm. And she's now made clear once and for all that any final Brexit deal will have to go through Parliament and get approved by both houses.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if they do oppose it? Would then one certain aspect that they take issue with get renegotiated, or would the entire deal get thrown out the window and drafted up again? How would that work?
So, again, the government hasn't confirmed exactly what the parliamentary process will look like, and we would expect that to be included perhaps in the Great Repeal Bill that's expected in the next parliamentary session. But what the Prime Minister said yesterday was that there would be a vote in both houses, and what that suggests is that Parliament won't get a chance to amend bits of legislation because there won't be a bill for it to look at. It will only have the chance to say yes or no to the motion that is put to it by the government. So the implication of that is that the Parliament won't be able to amend bits that it doesn't like. It will only have the chance to agree to or to decline the deal that's put to it. And then if it declines the deal, then the government would have a number of options. You know, one would be to go back to the EU and the 27 member states and try and extend the negotiating period to try and get a different deal and then put that to Parliament. Or it could decide to simply leave the EU anyway, but without a deal in place. Although, of course, if the UK left without that deal having been agreed and ratified, there would be a lot of uncertainty about the status of the UK-EU relationship at the point of exit.
Is this then just sort of a formality because May assumes that Parliament isn't going to say no to this offer because it would face, I'm assuming Parliament would face a lot of backlash if they just said no to a deal. Mm-hmm. Is this then just a formality of being like, we put it to them and they kind of are obligated to say yes even if they take issues with certain parts of the deal?
Well, I think it would be very risky of Theresa May to just assume that Parliament will pass the deal. I mean, she doesn't know what kind of deal she's going to get, so she can't assume that Parliament will just accept it, you know, for fear of being criticised by the public. But again, what I imagine the Prime Minister will be thinking about is how does she engage Parliament throughout the negotiations so that MPs are aware of the kind of deal that is taking shape, so that when she finally puts the final deal to them, she can be confident that MPs will accept the deal because they've been informed of it all the way through. And again, you know, we don't know exactly how MPs will be kept informed, but you know, you might have private sessions of the Select Committee for Exiting the EU with the Prime Minister or with the Chief Negotiator. You might have public statements in the House after each negotiating round. But certainly, it would be sensible for the Prime Minister to not simply ignore Parliament for the next 2 years and then come back to them with a deal. What would make sense and what would help to ensure that deal would be acceptable to Parliament would be to kind of test the water with MPs as you go so that you know that what you're negotiating is going to be acceptable to them.
Thanks, Robin. Both the Prime Minister and David Davis said they want to crack down on immigration, but that retaining an open border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland is a top priority. Aren't these two conflicting ideals?
Not necessarily. I mean, if you think about it at the moment, you know, the Republic of Ireland is in the Schengen agreement with the EU. Northern Ireland, because it's part of the UK, is not part of that. So there are already two different immigration systems working on the island of Ireland. How easy it would be to maintain that open border while controlling immigration would to an extent depend on the kind of immigration system that the UK wanted to put in place after Brexit. So if it was going to be something that relied heavily on border control, then you know, that could have implementation challenges, because you might have quite a lot of people going back and forth across the border and you might have to look at border control. Another option would be to perhaps have some form of kind of in-country registration. So, for example, now if you're going from the UK to the US, I can't remember the name of the program, but you go online and you put in your details before you go. So you're sort of cleared from immigration in advance before you get to the border. So that would be another way of doing it that would relieve some of the pressure at the point of crossing the border in Ireland. So there are lots of different ways in which a new immigration system could be designed, and it could be made to work with an open border.
Okay. So there must be some fears over the border control issue, though.
There are fears over the border control issue. I mean, the main topic of conversation about Ireland at the moment, of course, is the collapse of the Northern Ireland government. So there are a few questions about the kind of the status of that and how it affects Brexit. And there are obviously real political concerns about the implications of getting rid of the open border for the Northern Ireland peace process, for example. But I think there are ways around it, and you could make it work.
Could you just, for people who might not be completely aware of the situation, give a little brief explanation of what exactly happened with the Northern Ireland government and how that might impact Brexit?
To give a bit of background on the Northern Ireland situation, so the Northern Ireland Assembly has a power-sharing agreement, which means that the two main political parties share power between them. And one of the partners in that power-sharing agreement resigned over a policy issue relating to a renewable heat incentive that had been badly designed and effectively was losing the government money because it was over-subsidising the use of renewable heat. So he resigned. And because that party then refused to replace
him, so that was Sinn Féin's Martin McGuinness.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And because Sinn Féin didn't offer a replacement for Martin McGuinness, that means that elections will be happening to elect a new power-sharing government. What's that, sorry?
In the interim, it's ruled by Westminster again?
Yes, I think that's right.
Sorry.
The implications for Brexit are not clear. I mean, the state of the government in Northern Ireland won't necessarily affect Brexit, but it remains to be seen. I mean, this is an unprecedented situation, so there are lots of unknowns out there.
More uncertainty. May's declaration of a hard Brexit seems like another reason for Nicola Sturgeon to, announce that we're going to leave the single market. Another reason for the Scottish National Party's Nicola Sturgeon to call for an independence referendum. How likely do you think that is?
Well, I think a number of factors have to align before Nicola Sturgeon will call a second independence referendum. I mean, the obvious one is that she would want to have a good chance of winning it. And I haven't looked at the polls in the last week or so, but before that, I know there hadn't been a great deal of movement in favour of independence in Scotland. So I think she'd be unlikely to call a second independence referendum unless she had a very good chance of being successful. The other thing to say is that it's not necessarily in Nicola Sturgeon's gift to give a second referendum. The first independence referendum had to be agreed with the UK government, and my understanding is that Westminster had to pass a piece of legislation to give the Scottish government the power to hold a referendum. So if there were to be a second referendum, it's not something that Nicola Sturgeon could just do unilaterally. She would have to get Westminster's agreement. So I think we're still quite a way away from saying that a second referendum is a certainty, and a number of different things would have to come together for it to be, you know, worth the Scottish Government pursuing one.
And further afield in mainland Europe, how have reactions generally been to the speech?
Well, so interestingly, there were a couple of commentators talking on the radio this morning, and they said that there hadn't been a huge amount of reaction. You know, this hadn't been seen as a great headline-grabbing development. Other reactions have, I think, been to remind the UK that it cannot simply cherry-pick what it does and doesn't want to get from the deal. So, you know, it can't say it wants nothing to do with free movement of people and nothing to do with the ECJ, but expect to get a brilliant free trade agreement or a great access to research funding, for example. So there have been some kind of rebuttals to Theresa May's portrayal as Brexit as being something that we can get, you know, in 2 years, get very easily and get without damaging our trade relationship. There have been some moves from Europe to kind of counter that perspective. And I think, you know, the other thing to say in all of this is that, you know, negotiations have, you know, by definition, have more than one partner involved. It's not just for Theresa May to set down what she wants and what she wants to discuss. There are, you know, 27 other member states whose views need to be taken into account. So it's certainly too early to start predicting what kind of deal we might get, because their views will be very important, and they will have a role in ratifying the final deal.
Thank you, Robin. And with the 27 other member states and Theresa May and all the negotiations that have got to happen, what's the next big moment in this that we should be looking out for?
So I think that, well, the next big moment would be a couple actually. So one would be the Supreme Court judgment on whether or not Parliament has a role in triggering Article 50. I mean, there's certainly less attention being paid to that because now the Prime Minister is seen as giving quite a lot more clarity about what she wants from the negotiations. And one of the concerns was that, you know, Parliament might not agree to trigger Article 50 until Parliament knew what the Prime Minister was aiming for. Now it does have a pretty good idea of what she's aiming for, so it may be happier to agree to trigger negotiations. So then after that ruling, the next big event would be the triggering of Article 50. You know, the EU institutions have repeatedly said that they won't start negotiating until the UK government formally, you know, pulls the trigger and formally notifies the EU that it intends to leave. So that will be the point when negotiations really begin and when we might learn a bit more about what the EU wants to see from the negotiations, because it's expected that the EU Commission will publish, will receive a mandate from the EU Council saying this is the kind of deal that the EU states want, and that will be a very interesting moment when we find out what the EU might be willing to give to the UK. That'd be interesting to balance up Theresa May's vision of a future relationship with what we hear from the EU.
Robin, thank you. Thanks again for coming on the show and bringing some much needed clarity to everything Brexit. And we look forward to catching up with you soon.
As always, thanks for listening. And if you enjoy the show, please subscribe to us on your podcast platform of choice so you'll be notified whenever we upload a new episode and you'll be able to tune in. In the meantime, you can find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Brexit Podcast. The show is produced by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming, and Warren Paul, and our theme song is Cool Vibes by Kevin MacLeod.